The excuse me, the House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. Committee Legislative Assistant, call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Szymanski?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Anderson?
Here.
Campion?
Here.
Cornish?
Here.
Grunhagen?
Here.
Gilstrom?
Here.
Kreisel?
Here.
Lane, excuse, Lesh? Liebling?
Here.
Mazarol?
Here.
Schumacher?
Here.
Tilbury?
Here.
Vogel?
Here.
Wardlow?
Here.
Chair notes that a quorum is present, so we do have some minutes in our packet, specifically a set from January 25, 2011. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Szymanski moves approval of the minutes for January 25, 2011. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Representative Champion.
Just a point of clarification. I did have an opportunity to take a look at the minutes over a couple sessions, and I noticed that it usually reflects members who are absent, and then later in the body of the minutes, it talks about, you know, them now present. And I'm just suggesting maybe as a way to have clear minutes is once the person comes in that they wouldn't be identified as absent if they're actually here, so that there's no confusion if someone just takes a quick glance at the minutes and believes that the person is not here. So if you look at where it says committee members absent, it identifies Cornish, Lesh, Lieveling, and Tilbury. But then if you look in the body, it says committee members Cornish, Lesh, Liebling, and Tilbury now present. And I think that just adds some confusion, and I would ask the chair to think about that.
Very good. Thank you. Back on the 25th, Representative Szymanski moves approval of the minutes, January 25, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails, and the minutes of January 25 are approved. Members, we do need to make a minor correction on at this point on previous minutes from the January 18, 2011 meeting to properly list which members were present, excused, or absent. They're in the packet. May I have a motion to amend those minutes from January 18, 2011? Representative Szymanski so moves. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and those minutes are stand corrected. All right. On our agenda today is House File 1, and we do have some further overviews. Chair would like to now bring House File 1 by Representative Fabian before the committee. Is there a motion to do so, to bring House File 1 before this committee?
Mr. Chair, I move House File 1.
Representative Mazarol moves House File 1. Before I'm going, the chair will recognize Representative Fabian to explain his bill. And would you have a seat at the table, Representative Fabian? Representative Fabian has two author amendments that he would like to have added in order to put the bill in its proper form.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I move the first author's amendment.
Representative Szymanski moves author's amendment to House File 1. I believe, Representative Fabian, that's labeled H0001A13. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is there any discussion on that? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and that amendment, excuse me, is adopted. We have an additional amendment in the packet, which is styled A11-0030. Is there a motion? Representative Wardlow?
Mr. Chair, I move author's amendment labeled A11-0030.
Representative Fabian, with regard to this motion, looking at line 1.12, do you have, I understand you'd like this amendment amended by deleting the words in preparing and inserting the words for support of on line 0.112.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Wardlow, would you incorporate that requested amendment to your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Wardlow incorporates that amendment. We're now back on amendment A11-0030.
Mr. Chair, if I could
ask Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is about the data practices issue, and is the testifier going to talk about that piece? We had a lot of discussion in the last committee about that, and if you want to talk about it before or after, just so that we know what it is and what it does, that would be helpful. Whatever time you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Very good. I think there will be testimony.
Okay. Testimony. Representative Wardlow again moves the author's amendment to House File 1 labeled A11-0030 as incorporated. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Fabian, we now have the bill before us, but before you proceed, I'd like to ask for a show of hands. Who is present that will be testifying in support of this bill? Raise your hand. I see one hand. I see potentially two. All right. Anyone present who choosing to testify in opposition to this bill, raise your hand. I see one. All right. So we have three testifiers. The reason I'm doing this is to see how much time we're going to have. Representative Fabian, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House File 1 to me is a bill, obviously, that's for streamlining our permitting processes when it deals with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources. For too long, I think that those permits and so forth have taken too long. I think that this is a job that's going to help spur our job situation in our state. We have a number of situations in the district that I represent that have been affected by the delays that are associated with EISs and those types of things. I would like to see that corrected. And the main parts of the bill, we've got a goal of 150 days for the EIS reports to be completed. If the reports are not completed within the departments, we're asking them to submit a report so that we can determine why the reports are not being done. We also realize that's a goal. We would like to be able to work with the departments to identify which permits take longer, which permits take shorter periods of time, to see if we can't work to streamline the processes that are associated with that. We also want to require a final decision within 30 days of the submission of the EIS, so again, we can speed up this process. We also have provisions in there that will take the district court out of the process and go straight to the appeals court. Those would be the main points of the bill. If you would like me to explain them further, Mr. Chair, I would be glad to do that.
Yeah, I would like to hear from Mr. Lightfoot. Tell us who you are and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Thaddeus Lightfoot. I am an environmental lawyer with a law firm called the Environmental Law Group in Minneapolis. I am the former chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association's environmental law section. I practiced environmental law for over 20 years, and for the last 8 years have been an adjunct professor of environmental law at the William Mitchell College of Law. I also have extensive environmental review litigation experience of particular relevance to this committee. I have represented plaintiffs groups, responsible governmental units, and project proposers in litigation under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. And I would just briefly like to lend my support for removing district court jurisdiction in Minnesota Environmental Policy Act litigation and having those cases go directly to the Court of Appeals. I believe that that will streamline the process without undermining the rights of Minnesota citizens or undermining any of the rights in the statute. Right now, the district court and the Court of Appeals do exactly the same thing under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. They analyze the administrative record that is prepared by a responsible governmental unit. They look at the same administrative record on the same standard of review And they decide those issues on the law. There are no questions of facts decided in the district court. There's no discovery allowed in the district court. This is an administrative decision. Typically, administrative decisions of state agencies go directly to the Court of Appeals. Permits issued by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, for example, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, are directly reviewed in the Court of Appeals. There is no district court jurisdiction. The district court jurisdiction in the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is largely a relic of the statute, because when the statute was enacted by the legislature in 1973, there was no intermediate appellate court. The legislature didn't create the Court of Appeals until 1983, and when it did that, it amended a number of statutes, including the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, to remove district court jurisdiction and place jurisdiction of administrative, with respect to administrative decisions, exclusively in the Court of Appeals. That's what House File 1 does, and it does so without limiting the rights of any citizens. Let me just briefly respond to a couple of the questions that have been raised by some of the opponents of removing district court jurisdiction. First, it does not in any way limit citizen participation. Citizen participation in environmental review comes during the responsible governmental units hearing process. There are comments on draft documents. There is substantial opportunity for comments by the public during that process. But once the responsible governmental unit has made a decision that an environmental review document, an environmental impact statement, or an environmental assessment worksheet complies with the statute, there is no more citizen input, and there is no citizen input in the district court or the Court of Appeals. The administrative record is closed. Second, eliminating district court jurisdiction will not force outstate Minnesotans to travel to St. Paul to have their day in court. The citizens get their day in court by not providing testimony in this case, or in these cases, but by having their lawyers submit legal arguments. And both that happens in both the district court and the Court of Appeals. The Minnesota Rules of Appellate Procedure also allow counsel to request the Court of Appeals hold oral arguments at sessions in the judicial district where the petitioner resides. So there is an opportunity to have those hearings of the Court of Appeals, those oral arguments, outstate if counsel so requests. Third, the appellate filing fees are no more costly in the Court of Appeals than it is to resolve MEPA cases in district court. In district court right now, there's approximately a $330 filing fee to file a complaint, but then these cases are resolved on motions, typically cross motions for summary judgment on the law, which means that a party pays not only $330 to bring an action, but another roughly $200 in motion fees to resolve the matter. The Court of Appeals filing fee is $550, roughly the same amount that it costs to resolve these cases in district court. And, of course, if you go to the district court first and then go to the Court of Appeals now under the statute, you end up paying $1,100 in filing fees. Eliminating district court jurisdiction doesn't deprive the plaintiffs of any right of discovery. As I mentioned, there is no discovery in these cases. They are handled on an administrative record. The Court of Appeals is designed to handle these cases right now without duplicating district court litigation. They handle the cases now on appeal from the district court. They consider the entire administrative record, not just transcripts and briefs of the district court. And there's no deference to the district court judgment because the district court judgment is made on a matter of law. Parties that take these cases to the Court of Appeals don't need to hire appellate specialists. Environmental lawyers handle these cases typically, not trial lawyers in the district court right now, because there is no evidence to be developed in district court. And I've had I've litigated roughly 12 of these cases, and in only one case was the lawyer in the Court of Appeals different than the lawyer in the district court, and that, I believe, was just a function of that lawyer's caseload. Finally, eliminating district court jurisdiction is not going to change the administrative record in any way or make it more difficult for plaintiffs to coordinate environmental actions. The administrative record is established by a responsible governmental unit now, not by a district court. And with respect to the question of being in two forums, although there are certain zoning regulations and conditional use permits that district courts right now have exercised exclusive jurisdiction over, district courts do not have jurisdiction over major environmental permits issued by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, or other state agencies. So right now, if you challenge an underlying project on environmental review and an environmental permit, you're in two forums. This would in fact consolidate the forums and make it easier in many respects to challenge those cases. So ultimately, district court jurisdiction is duplicative and unnecessary. I think it is a historical quirk. It needs to be eliminated, as House File 1 does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lightfoot, thank you. Any questions, Representative Hillstrom?
I have quite a few, Mr. Chair, actually. First is a question of you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that one of the amendments that we put on was data practices, and I believe data practices is not in the jurisdiction of this committee. Is it going to be your practice to accept amendments outside the jurisdiction of this committee going forward on other bills as well, or is it only amendments that have been previously agreed to, or what is going to be your policy so we make certain we're prepared?
Representative Hills. Representative Hillstrom, I was not being coached, by the way. that sounded like a three-part question, not necessarily in order of importance. First of all, Representative Fabian was aware of this amendment, and as a courtesy, we've attached it here because he isn't any particular. It was brought up in civil law, you are correct, and the author of the bill, as a courtesy, I think informed the Civil Law Committee that he would pursue it. Number two, no, it's not going to be a general policy that we go outside the purview of this committee. However, the chairman will determine that on a case-by-case basis, taking into consideration what I understand the author and the Civil Law Committee have talked about in the past. I hope that at least addresses your questions if it doesn't answer them.
It does, Mr. Chair. The only reason for my question is I was on the Civil Law Committee, stated that I would be willing to work with the author and Representative Holberg to make certain that the issues that we brought forward were addressed. That's the first I've seen of the language, so I've not had an opportunity to even be enlightened about what the end result is, Mr. Chair. That's the reason for the question. So I would assume there'll be some discussion about where it ended up, to make certain that those issues were addressed. So that's the first question. Then I have a couple questions for the testifier, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, go ahead, and I do appreciate your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, does the environmental section of the bar support this proposal, or has it gone through their process?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, in addition to being on the governing council of the Minnesota State Bar Association's environmental law section, I'm also the chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association's legislative committee. So I can tell you that it has not been considered by the environmental law section. I can also tell you that as a matter of policy, the environmental law section is one of the least active legislatively in terms of supporting or opposing particular amendments, because half of us represent the regulated community and half of us represent responsible governmental units and environmental groups. And so it is very difficult for the environmental law section to come to a conclusion with respect to any particular given legislation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's helpful then when you speak about your experience and your credentials that you state that you're not speaking on behalf of the organization going forward. Another question, Mr. Chair. Do you know how many of these cases currently go to court and then go to the Court of Appeals versus how many cases you anticipate will just straight go to the Court of Appeals? And then have you spoken to the court, and do you know if the Court of Appeals has the capacity to deal with these given the budget cuts that and budget constraints that we're under?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I personally have not spoken with the court. I believe that that others have, and I would defer that question to Representative Fabian. In my experience, most of the cases that are brought in district court, most environmental review cases that are brought in district court right now, are appealed to the Court of Appeals by one of the parties. Not all of them, but most of them are. But I cannot tell. I cannot give you specific numbers.
Mr. Chair, if we could inquire of the author.
Representative Hillstrom, yes, if you would, this time, however, temporarily defer to Representative Wardlaw, I think he wants to try to answer in additionally on this point. Would that be all right? Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Representative Hillstrom, Representative Fabian, with regard to the A11-0030 amendment, I've been working with Representative Holberg and Representative Fabian and committee staff, and I think this represents this current draft, as adopted amendment, really addresses all the concerns we talked about in civil law committee. As you know, there was concern that some of the data might not be public if the proposer is preparing that data and then just submitting the report. On the other hand, there are also concerns that if the language is too broad, it could allow for government agencies to reach in and get data that's private that the government should not have recourse to. So this language has been thoroughly vetted and basically says that anything, and you can read it, it's very clear, I think, any data collected, received, or maintained in support of any particular specific project in support of the environmental impact statement draft that will be submitted is going to be deemed public data, and I think it addresses the concerns we all talked about in civil law pretty well.
Mr. Chair.
We'll go back to Representative Hillstrom, and then after that, Representative Johnson and Lash. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Representative Wardlaw, something that has only been vetted by one party in the legislature is not fully vetted. Just so you know, I committed on the record in committee that I'd be happy to work with the author and with Representative Holberg, and I would have expected that I would have at least seen the language.
Anything further?
Nothing.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, is there a fiscal note being prepared on this particular bill, and will we have a chance to see that before it moves to the House floor?
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a preliminary fiscal note that I have received, and I have looked through it. I don't know which particular section you would be referring to because it's broken down into the Natural Resources Pollution Control Agency and the Supreme Court. Overall, over the period of time, over a four-year period, there is a cost savings of about $100,000.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Question about the legislative auditor's report that's going to be released in February. I'm just curious, why are we pursuing this and pushing this forward without first getting the results of that particular report? Why don't we wait to hear what the findings are and conclusions from that before we move forward?
Well, for me, Ms.
Excuse me, Representative Johnson.
My question is concluded, and we're waiting for his acknowledgement, I guess, Representative Fabian.
Representative Fabian, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for me, this is a matter that I want to get on a fast track, you might say. Obviously, would like to be able to allow people to have all the input that they can into this issue. It's been before three different committees now. It's going to another committee after this, I assume. For me, it's important that people in my district understand that this is something that they sent me down here to work on, and I'm trying to send a message to my constituents that I'm down here doing the work that they've asked me to do.
Okay, we've got, are you done, Representative Johnson? We're going to go back to Representative Hillstrom, then Lash, then Tilbury. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to talk about the fiscal things, and so if you want to get through the policy, Mr. Chair, concerns, I'd be happy to make a little statement.
You've got the floor.
Mr. Chair, listening to the testifier, I just heard that there was a fiscal note. This is a fiscal committee. We have not seen it. I believe this is the proper place for us to debate fiscal considerations of the court. And Mr. Chair, I did come over and ask you about that, and You indicated that we are going to be moving forward. Mr. Chair, I'm very disappointed that this committee is going to be waiving the fiscal issues, and that while some folks have information about the fiscal implications, others do not. That is not the common practice of this legislature, and I'm very disappointed in the process.
Representative Hillstrom, thank you. Representative Lass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lightfoot, between the beginning of session now, I had a chance to take a look at the platforms and campaign literature of many of the people around this table, the principles on which they ran and which they're going to carry forward here at the legislature to represent people. And many of them had indicated clearly they support a principle of local control, that decisions are made better at the local level than shipping them off to St. Paul. Why is it that you think it's a good idea to put this issue up to a vote and make people around this table vote against their principles of supporting local control in this instance?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have the I guess misfortune of never run for anything, not running for anything, any elective office. So I can't speak to the question of what individual members around the table said in their particular campaign literature. I can say, as I said in the Civil Law Committee, that the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is the anomaly in this area rather than the norm, in that the district courts lack jurisdiction over agency decisions by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I believe, based upon this legislature's change to the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act in 1983 to remove district court jurisdiction, that it makes more sense for the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act litigation to go to the Court of Appeals rather than spend time in the district court. The time in the district court is duplicative, in my judgment, because the district court and the Court of Appeals do exactly the same thing under this statute.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe then it's a better question for the author. Representative Fabian, I asked this last committee, but I'm still confused, and maybe you've had time to formulate a better answer now. Why do you think, Representative Fabian, it's a good idea for the folks around this table to vote against principles of local control?
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd like to preface that by saying that there is broad support for this within the agencies. I've had communications with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. For me, it's an issue about people having their day, and it's not, I'm not intending, nor do I want people to not have their day in court. I do know that our district courts are very full. I've had conversations with our people up there leading into this legislative session, and for me it does not seem that anyone is not going to be able to be represented by this. I'm in favor of the bill as it's written, and I think it's a good bill.
Representative Tilbury, then Cornish. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for you, Representative Fabian. When Representative Johnson had asked you if you had a fiscal note on that, that was because we didn't have anything in our files, nothing to show that there was a fiscal note. You had stated that, well, I have a preliminary fiscal note. Wouldn't it have been customary, or at least considerate, to pass that out to the committee that you had that?
Representative Tilbury, I'll answer that question for the author. There is a preliminary fiscal note. Fiscal, a nonpartisan fiscal staff has informed this chairman that it is not custom to pass out preliminary numbers. With regard to that preliminary fiscal note, I'll repeat this when Representative Hillstrom returns. The only area that this committee has purview over is the judiciary or the Supreme Court, and the preliminary numbers show a cost savings of $112,000 on balance with the elimination of a trial court judge unit and the appeals court cost increase. A net savings to the state of $112,000. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, that just would have been nice to know.
I realize that, but again, I'm just advising you that custom that I'm familiar with does not permit handing out preliminary notes, but it's on the record, and it's here. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment. I don't call, Representative Lesh, I don't call a district court anything even close to local control. The traveling judge, several counties, making decisions based on law, nothing to do with anything local at all, any kind of local control. So I don't think Representative Fabian is abandoning a local control initiative. And then, moreover, PCA has brought them on this on themselves. They're out of control, infamous for delays for business and farms. In my district, a farmer had a project okayed by the county. He had it okayed by NRCS. He was going to push a building in and cover it with trees. Wonderful project for the landscape and the environment. And the PCA came in and said, no, you can't do that, even though Environmental Service and Local Control had said yes. They could do that, and NRCS had a contract with them. And PCA, I got involved, called the PCA, trying to get to the bottom of it. And they said, well, you finally, after months, they said, you can apply for a variance. Then I said, how long will that take? She said, to get a hold of all the people and decide a variance, it could take up to a year. Meanwhile, the dozers went home. He couldn't finish his project. And that's basically one of the reasons why we're here. So thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, Representative Cornish. You have your own reasons. I don't know if other people around the table do. If they do, they're obviously welcome to comment on the record. But my question was specific to Representative Fabian due to the uniqueness of the issue going counter to many people's principles around the table. So I appreciate your explanation.
All right. We have Representative Lane and Champion. And if there's no other questions, we're going to move on to the next testifier. Representative Hillstrom, I just want to repeat what I said while you were out for a moment. Under question from Representative Tilbury with regard to the fiscal note, there is a preliminary fiscal note. I'm informed as chairman that preliminary fiscal notes are not customarily included in packets or handed out, but I can tell you, and I did on the record already, the preliminary numbers show to that area that is in the purview of this committee, the judiciary and the Supreme Court, that with the transfer, with the elimination of the trial judge unit cost reduction and the appeals court cost increase, there's a net savings to the state of $112,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was out of the room trying to get those numbers.
All right. All right.
Mr. Chair?
We have Representative Lane and Champion. I'm sorry, Liebling. I'm looking at your neighbor's plane.
Thank
I apologize.
I kept looking to see if she was back. thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask the chair, you know, obviously this is a committee that's primarily concerned with the judicial system, that is concerned with the judicial system, the impact on the courts, and I appreciate hearing the number, at least, that's in the preliminary. But I'm wondering if we're going to have some testimony from the courts, because I, you know, when you just said this fiscal note has the elimination of a judicial unit, that raises some red flags for me. And I'd like to know, you know, where these eliminations are, what they're going to eliminate if this goes forward. And I, Mr. Chair, I'm also very disappointed that we aren't really discussing this information. It seems to me that the chair is going to be a stickler for what I consider minor things, like if you're 5 minutes late, you appear in the minutes as having been absent, and we just had a little discussion about that, which I think Representative Champion was absolutely right. So the chair is obviously going to be a stickler for very minor things. But the real reason that this committee is here and that a bill comes to this committee is for the members to fully explore the impact on the judiciary. And it seems to me that today we're dealing with an issue that is going to have some impacts on the judiciary, and we are not fully exploring that issue. So I hope that as we move forward, we are not going to be substituting minor procedural things for the real reason that we are here, serving our constituents and serving the state, examining these issues fully. So I'd like to know whether we're going to have people from the courts here to talk to us about what they see the impact on the courts. from this bill.
All right, Representative Liebling, two responses, then we're going to move on. Number one, if I said or suggested that a trial court judge unit would be eliminated, I misspoke. The workload will be transferred. There will be no elimination of the trial judge unit. In fact, this state, and we're going to get to that later in our session, this state is down by 20 judgeships, and we really need the money from my leadership corner to fund those completely. So there is no elimination of a judge. There's only transfer of the work. And secondly, the courts have the same notice as everyone else that this was on today. If they felt a savings was not necessary to respond to, I can't drag anyone into this room. Representative Champion, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of things, Mr. Chair. The first thing that I would like to say is I am a novice when it comes to understanding some of the uniqueness of how the committee operates. Although this is my second term, and I think I have some intellectual capacity around what should happen or what shouldn't happen. Mr. Chair, I hear you so eloquently talk about this fiscal note being preliminary and this fiscal note historically not being distributed to the committee. But yet I also hear you, Mr. Chair, on the other hand, using the numbers of the fiscal note in order to justify that this particular policy or this particular bill should go forward. You have so eloquently talked about it being a savings. And if you could talk about the numbers, and if you can talk about it being a savings, then I would suggest that you're suggesting to us that we should have a copy of those numbers, especially if we are looked upon in order to make a decision today as to whether this bill should leave this committee and go to another committee, Mr. Chair. So I would hope that in real time that you might consider this committee should get all information so that we can make informed decisions based on the information that is before us. And I feel that there's an inability to do that if you're using the numbers and holding it to your breast and you're talking and reading from it. But we as individuals who are elected to this body to represent our constituents don't have the same information. So I think that if something's going to be totally private, you should just say, there's a preliminary report and we're not going to speak to it and go on. But don't, on the other hand, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, you know, then articulate the savings when it's a preliminary number. And so I would hope that the chair would be respectful. Well, I'm being respectful, and that you would think about that. And if I could ask a question, Mr. Chair, of the testifiers, I would like to do so.
Representative Champion, certainly. But before you do that, I am not necessarily pleased with what I reported to you about the absence of a preliminary note. So I will take a look at that and see if I can get that changed. Secondly, with moving back a little bit with regard to your suggestions about reporting on the minutes, I would ask you to see the committee administrator and me after this hearing, and we'll see what we can do to change it so that it's not offensive. Ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lightfoot, you've talked about the review process, and that currently, if my memory serves me correctly, you say that the review process requires it going to the district court, and then if a party wants to appeal, then it can then go to the Court of Appeals. My question is firstly, is if it's at the district court level, it's my understanding that that currently these reviews are by a district court in the county where the proposed action would take place. Is that right?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, yes, that is correct. That's the way the statute is written now.
And wouldn't you agree, or at least, you know, give me your thoughts as to what do you believe the significance of the notion that a district court in the area where the proposed action would take place, what is the significance of that when we think in terms of this review process?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I'm not sure why the legislation was drafted that way in 1973, although it makes sense to have, since there was no intermediate appellate court, and if you were going to have district court jurisdiction, just in terms of venue issues, it makes sense to venue it in the district in which the project is proposed. However, the Court of Appeals now has review over agency actions on permits and throughout the state. So it doesn't really, it doesn't matter wherever the permit is going to be, issued in the district court, in district court review, or in the court of appeals review right now, is irrelevant. If a permit is issued for a facility in International Falls by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the court of appeals has jurisdiction over that permit and any appeal of that permit. As I said before, I think that the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act is the anomaly here, not other permitting decisions by agencies.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Champion.
Isn't something to be said about notice being provided whenever property or something within in a certain jurisdiction is going to be affected by an action? Isn't there some connection of notice from a legal perspective?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, there is ample notice under the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act for individuals in a district in which a project is proposed to participate in the environmental review on that project. There is notice that is published in the Environmental Quality Board Monitor, the EQB Monitor. There are a number of draft documents that are prepared in this in these procedures upon which parties comment. There are a number of final documents prepared in these procedures in which parties comment. And in fact, unlike the National Environmental Policy Act, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act expressly allows comments on final documents. So parties get the opportunity to comment on both a draft and a final. And if so, there's ample opportunity for parties to participate. There are often hearings with respect to these projects in the districts in which the projects will occur. So I guess I would suggest that by simply removing district court jurisdiction and placing jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals, you are not affecting the notice provisions of the statute or the ability of individuals to participate in the statute during the environmental review process.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Champion.
Follow up. Mr. Lightfoot, wouldn't you also agree, I believe you said earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's the filing fee, and if there's going to be motion practice between the parties at that district court level, there therein would be an increase of the cost, which would amount to the same amount of fees that you would pay to the Court of Appeals. But my question is particularly around motion practice. You would also agree that on the district court level, if there is some motion, some unique issues that need to be fleshed out by way of hearings, that the district court is in a better position by which to do it, especially in the same jurisdiction where the proposed action is looking to take place. Wouldn't you agree with that, or tell me what you think about that?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, respectfully, I would not agree. These matters are resolved on the law, and when I speak in terms of motion practice, I speak in terms of motions, cross motions for summary judgment, which means each party in the action brings its own motion saying, we win on the law. We should win on the law. That's how you do that in district court. Those are the same legal arguments that are made in the Court of Appeals, and they're if the case goes to the Court of Appeals on appeal. In fact, the Court of Appeals cannot hear new legal arguments with respect to the legal arguments that are made in district court. So, unlike the typical district court case, where it's ultimately resolved on summary judgment, there's no discovery here. There's no motion practice that relates to discovery at all. Occasionally, a party will attempt to supplement the administrative record on a motion practice, but it's the same standard that you would use to attempt to supplement the administrative record in the Court of Appeals on a motion. So it really, the District Court and the Court of Appeals in this unique circumstance are doing exactly the same thing, unlike other district court cases.
No, we have two more questions over here, Representative Champion. One more, then within 5 minutes we'll take a few more questions, then we need to give some equal time to Mr. King, who's waiting to testify, and then about a half hour from now we'll discuss this bill and vote on it. Representative Champion, one more question.
No further questions from me.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Johnson or Hillstrom, did either one of you have a question? Representative?
I'll wait for testimony.
I can wait.
All right. Mr. Lightfoot, thank you. I'm going to call Mr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have a seat at the table, identify yourself, and then proceed, please.
My name is, Mr. Chair, my name is Bobby King. I'm representing the Land Stewardship Project. We're a farm and rural organization here in Minnesota. This issues and Bill's often talked about with primarily two entities involved, the RGU and the proposer, but the third group that's involved and needs to be considered is the public, which is an integral part of environmental review, often leads to better projects, and that's how Land Stewardship Project has been involved in environmental review cases. Our members in situations where they think the agency has made a bad decision, have chosen to raise the money themselves. We don't have money for this. They raise it themselves and have the decision reviewed in court. These are for our members, and in these cases are farm and rural people who are really concerned about the ongoing impact of a large development in their community and how it's going to impact their farm and their home and their small businesses for decades or the rest of their life. And they want to be a part of the process, and that means being present in court. And if we move this to appellate court directly, it'll be difficult or impossible for in the situations we've been involved in for people to be there and see the justice process work. We've got 87 district courts. Those are symbols in those communities of access to justice, access to the courts. And I think people feel a lot better about the process when those district courts are used and they can be present in the courtroom. The last point I want to make, in all the cases that our members have been involved in, it's involved environmental review and a local permit, a zoning permit. So in all the cases our members have been involved in, it would have split the cases and driven up the cost substantially and perhaps made it too costly to pursue. That's the extent of my comments.
Very good. Succinct and to the point. Questions from anyone? Yes. Paige, we have some written testimony if you'd come and get it from someone who chose to not be here, and I'd like you to pass it out. And a question was raised off the record where an individual fiscal analyst was. Well, our fiscal analyst assigned to this committee, her name is Emily. She sits over here. When she comes back, I'm going to ask her to address the issue of custom on preliminary notes, and then you will see that the chairman has made a decision to waive that custom in this case and probably will do so down the road so we can shorten some of these hearings. And the note will be passed out when it arrives. Any additional testifiers? I see none. Any questions of the author? Just for the record, the item that's being passed out is from the Minnesota Farmers Union. It's dated Monday, January 24. It's addressed to myself, but it's to the committee, and it's signed by a Tom or a Thom Peterson, Minnesota Farmers Union. And it's a letter and testimony. It's being received for the record. Okay. We have copies going around? We'll make copies, get them around. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just up talking to the court, and even if they're not going to say something, I'd like to know why. So if you'd be so kind as to call them down and ask them if they have an opinion, and if they choose not to say, I'd just like that to be on the record so that one can't say the courts did not have an opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, I can do that. Is there anyone else in the audience you want to have come and talk so I can determine how much time they should each have?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Whoever's sitting down, identify yourself, and apparently there's a question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Rehack, and I am the court's coordinator of the fiscal note process, and I feel, given your discussion, like I need to apologize to you for not having this fiscal note completed in time for this hearing. But let me tell you what our fiscal note process is within the court so that perhaps you'll have some understanding of that. We have a committee of judges, court administrators, district administrators from around the state who have experience in different kinds of litigation, different kinds of court environment, who work with me and other members of state court administration staff in preparing the fiscal notes. Because of the difficulty in getting judges together at a time when they are not scheduled for court business, we have established a process of a weekly conference call to confer about the fiscal notes that we've been requested to do. This week, for example, we'll be discussing 16 fiscal notes which have been requested in the past week. And this, unfortunately, was one of those scheduled for discussion this afternoon. That's why it is a preliminary fiscal note. I would say that from my perspective, as a person who has been involved in the fiscal note preparation process for almost 40 years now, my understanding is the same as the chair's, that when the fiscal note is preliminary, it is not generally distributed for public consumption. Our discussions will test the assumption of the fiscal note when we meet this afternoon. I'm not infallible. The information that we gather when it's challenged by the give and take of a discussion process, much like yours, sometimes results in different results. And so that's why it's still preliminary at this stage in the process. With respect to the substance of the bill itself, I'm not here as a subject matter expert. That isn't the role that the fiscal note coordinator plays, and I'm not sure that someone in the court environment would be here to testify about the substantive matters in front of you this morning.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. And it becomes apparent to me that the problem is not with the courts or with the fiscal note process. The problem is with the process here and the rushing through and the recklessness with which this bill is being rushed through the process. There is a process set up here. We've got the legislative auditor that's worked this issue very carefully and is going to be giving us some findings. The court and the other agencies of government are used to working on a certain kind of timetable where they're able to reflect on what they are being asked to do and change, and that's how we get hopefully decent policy in the state that's not just responsive to somebody's political agenda, but that actually works for the people of the state. And Mr. Chair, I am just really disappointed with this process, not with the courts, not with the testifier who is explaining to us that they indeed would have a solid fiscal note that's been fully vetted in their process if we weren't rushing this bill through to accomplish something that doesn't need to be accomplished on any kind of speedy timetable, and that we would all be better served, all our constituents would be better served by having this go through in the normal course, waiting for the auditor's report and giving the courts time to fully vet their fiscal note before they present it here. So, Mr. Chair, I just really wanted to make that statement. I'm very disappointed with this. Not with the chair handing out or not handing out the fiscal note. I think that's a minor issue, because if we'd done this in the correct way and this wasn't being recklessly rushed through, we wouldn't be discussing this issue at all.
All right. Are there any other questions of this witness? Before we get any further into discussion of this bill, are there any other questions, or I'm going to close public testimony? Any questions of this witness? Representative Wardlow, then Johnson. Yes. None. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the fiscal note question, do you just have fiscal note information regarding the courts? Is that your sole jurisdiction on this?
Ms. Rehag.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my sole responsibility is the courts. There are other agencies involved in this particular fiscal note, as is often the case on a fiscal note, but the only one that I would be able to speak to would be the court.
And Mr.
Representative Johnson.
I guess this is to you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a fiscal note then that shows costs to, for example, the Environment Committee as well, or do you just have the fiscal note that they're referencing?
Representative Johnson, share with me what you just received. I think you've got the entire note. You don't have it yet? All right. You will now.
I'll hold my question then just for a minute.
While you're holding your question, Representative Johnson, fiscal analyst, if you'd have a seat and discuss the so-called custom on handling preliminary fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just to kind of shed some light on the process and to help, especially for the new members, part of the reason that we don't like to typically hand out fiscal notes until they're finished is that they're the way that it goes is so for this example, the courts and the other agencies involved in the language of the bill have a chance to go through and talk about the impact and their assumptions that the language will have. And then when they sign off on it and finish, it goes to an executive budget officer with the Minnesota Management and Budget Agency. And then they have a chance to kind of look over the information, make sure that they think it seems appropriate. And then they sign off on as well on it, and then it comes to us. And so it's nice to have it go through this entire process just to make sure that the information is accurate and everything, and things can change. So it's sort of a two-edged thing. When we have the information that's preliminary, we do know that it's necessary to have something, even if it's preliminary information, to make decisions, especially on bills when you're passing them out of committees. But since it could be subject to change, it's sort of hard. So we like to have the information, but we're so often hesitant to, distribute it and pass it out. So that's kind of, so I apologize if it caused any strife for this committee, but that's just been our custom. And then I'm happy to go over this on page 10 of the preliminary note. Mr. Chair, so you all have the caveat that this is preliminary information and it can change. This is where the impact of House File 1 in the engrossed version, so this is before the amendments that were put on the language today. This shows the impact for the Supreme Court. And as the chair mentioned, it's the net impact is a savings of $112,000 to the general fund starting in fiscal year 2012 and ongoing. And then on page 11 is where the courts put in some of their assumptions that went into the impact that they put together. And then it shows under the trial court, this is where it talks about the judicial unit and what the savings would be to transfer that work caseload over to the Court of Appeals. And then under the summary, it shows the net effect. So the savings of $172,500 to the trial courts, with the increased cost of $60,000 to the appeals courts to give a net effect of $112,000 in savings.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to take us back to custom just a bit. I don't disagree that it is the custom of this body not to release preliminary fiscal notes. I don't disagree with that at all. It is, however, outside the custom of this body early in session to hear bills before fiscal notes are done in fiscal committees. So that, in my opinion, is where the custom of this body is changing at this moment. Mr. Chair, we have had a long and, I believe, good working relationship, and areas of public safety have consistently been bipartisan committees. It would be a shame to see those things change, Mr. Chair. And so I don't disagree that preliminary fiscal notes are not usually released. I don't disagree that there is a process by which to wait for fiscal notes. I do not question those at all, Mr. Chair. However, it is the custom of this body early in session to not hear fiscal bills before we have fiscal information, Mr. Chair. And that is where my concern is with the process.
Are there any further questions of this witness? If not, I'm going to close public testimony and any further testimony, and we'll go to discussion. Representative Johnson, did you have your hand up? Discussion on the bill. It's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it was question about, again, to the fiscal note. Presumably the Environment Committee didn't have a chance to review this information as well? Any of the fiscal note information? And my question, I guess, to you is, where was this going to go next after this committee?
Representative Johnson, I think the motion on before us is to have it re-referred to the House Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, very good. Well, I'd like to re-refer it to the Environment Committee so they have a chance to review this information that they haven't had a chance yet to take a look at.
We'll get to that motion if you choose to make it in due time. Any further discussion of the bill? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a technical change here, so I move for a technical change. If you, I'd refer you all to page 7 of the bill, new section 7, former section 6, line 20 on page 7. It's a very simple, small change. Given that our H0001A13 amendment contemplates, and the bill as drafted now contemplates, filing of a writ of certiorari to appeal decisions made by the responsible government units, we no longer have a plaintiff. So the word plaintiff in line 20 should actually, I think, more properly read petitioner. So I move that we strike plaintiff and replace it with petitioner.
Any discussion of that motion to amend? Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill. Any further discussion from the committee on the bill? All right. First, we'll renew the motion, then you can move to amend. Is that acceptable, Representative?
That's acceptable.
Representative Wardlow, I believe you had the original motion.
Masrall.
Representative Masrall renews the motion that House File 1, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the House Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Johnson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move to re-refer it to back to the Environment Committee. The reasoning being, sort of as we've discussed this morning, that we need to take a measured and thoughtful approach to dealing with the this policy. Whether it's good policy or bad policy, I guess, isn't the point so much as to make sure we have a clear and honest vetting what the issues are. And in as much as the Environment Committee didn't have this information before them, it just seems to make common sense that we have the opportunity for everyone to have all the information, have a thorough discussion of such major changes that are being proposed. So with that, I make my motion, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Any further discussion on the motion to amend the motion? All right, on the Representative Johnson's motion to amend the motion to refer it to
Environment.
All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. We're back on the original motion to pass the bill as amended to the House Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is off and running to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, committee.
We have a couple of overviews we're going to try and get in today. We have some time left on our calendar, so I would call, I believe, Suzanne Allegre.
Allegre.
Excuse me. Identify yourself and then talk to us about the Guardian Ad Litem program. Wait a moment till we have a little quiet in here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the program administrator for the new State Guardian Ad Litem Board. I understand you did have some discussion about the new board a couple of meetings back, and what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the board itself and some of the work that the guardians do.
Ms. Allegro, wait on a second. Those leaving, please do so quietly. Okay, go ahead.
As indicated on page 2 of your handout, that the purpose of the Guardian Ad Litem Board is to administer a statewide independent Guardian Ad Litem program to advocate for the best interests of children, minor persons, and incompetent adults at juvenile family court. I think the common mission for both the board and the individual guardian ad litems is to ensure quality representation for abused and neglected children. And as you're aware, last year the legislature created the new board to move the program out of the state court system and establish an independent guardian ad litem board. And the reason for this is over the years there had been discussion about whether the program was properly located in the court system. This was due to concerns about actual conflicts of interest or perceived conflicts of interest where the court was supervising a program where the people in the program were providing support and supervision to individuals who are party to certain proceedings. Over the years, the Guardian Ad Litem program itself, over the past 15 years, has undergone significant and continuous change. This started in 1995 with a report by the legislative auditor in response to a number of citizen complaints about the Guardian Ad Litem program. And at that time, the programs were administered by the individual counties, and as you can imagine, there were different ways that the counties ran the programs. There were different levels of funding, and I think the basic conclusion of the legislative auditor was that the programs had little consistency in areas such as recruitment, selection, supervision, training, an actual complaint process, and also removal process. In response to the legislative auditor, the Supreme Court did set up an advisory task force to look at these complaints and decide what to do. This resulted in 1999 for the Supreme Court promulgated rules of guardian ad litem procedure, which stipulated standards for recruitment, selection, training, and complaint processing. Once that was done in 2001, as I indicated before, that there was quite a bit of variation in how the different programs were run, and one of the reasons was the different levels of funding that the counties provided. The court then began looking at whether the program and the court system itself was moving to state funding, whether the Guardian Ad Litem program would be one of those programs that would move earlier to state funding. In 2002, the program did become, all the Guardian Ad Litem programs became state-funded, and the system was set up where the state supervised the program and it was administered in the different judicial districts. Over the years, in 2003, there were more revisions to the Minnesota Rules of Guardian Ad Litem Procedure. In 2005, a quality assurance review procedure was set up. In 2007, another committee was set up to examine the long-term and systemic changes facing the Guardian Ad Litem program and to make recommendations. The two major recommendations from this particular committee were to move the program out of the court and place it under an independent board. The other recommendation concerned the individual guardians themselves. Within the programs, the Hennepin and Ramsey had primarily volunteers serving as guardians. They also had some contractors, some paid staff. Within the other judicial districts, there was a combination of paid staff and contractors. The decision was made because of some of the issues. The court wanted greater supervision over the individual guardians. The decision was made to end the contractor system and move and go with just either employees or volunteers. This was accomplished last July, and it was no additional funding. It was accomplished within the existing budget. On page 5, per the legislature, the way the board is set up, it is set up in the judicial branch. However, the board is not subject to the administrative control of the judiciary. The board consists of 7 members. 3 are appointed by the Supreme Court, and three are appointed by the governor. One of the governor's appointees is chosen by the Supreme Court to be chair of the board, and then my position is hired by the board. The board was set up, they were appointed in October of 2010, and then this is my third week on the job, and I started, as indicated, a couple weeks ago. The legislature did set out certain requirements for board members, including no active judges on the board. For the attorney and public members, they did want them to have prior guardian ad litem experience. On page 6 and 7, I have indicated who the current board members are and just a brief summary of their qualifications. Page 8, there are several mandated duties of the board. First is to approve and recommend to you a budget for the board and the program, establish procedures for distribution of funding, and this would be for how the different 10 different programs would be funded, and this is primarily based on caseload. Also to establish standards, administrative policies, procedures, and rules that affect a guardian ad litem's work, and then to appoint the program administrator. The board did begin meeting right away once they were appointed, and the initial meetings were set up with recruiting for my position. And now we will begin the process of sort of looking at some of the policies and procedures. Additionally, there are certain three permissive duties of the board, and that would be to adopt standards, policies, or procedures necessary to ensure quality advocacy, propose statutory changes to the legislature and rule changes to the Supreme Court, and appoint an advisory committee. The guardian ad litem work itself is subject to both federal and state mandates. In 1974, the Congress enacted the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and in order for a state to receive federal funds, a state must enact and enforce laws mandating the appointment of a guardian ad litem in every juvenile case alleging that a child has been abused and neglected. The following year, the Minnesota legislature also enacted guardian ad litem statutes mandating appointment of a guardian ad litem on every juvenile and family court case. In the juvenile cases, the mandate is that the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem to protect a minor in every proceeding alleging a child's need for protective services. In family court, the mandate is to appoint a guardian if in any custody or parent, and in any family court case where custody or parenting time is an issue, if the court has reason to believe that minor children are the victim of domestic abuse or neglect. And there are statutory mandated duties that the individual guardian ad litems need to perform, and this is the legislature enacted these duties in 1996 based on, again, on the 1995 legislative auditor's report. One would be to conduct an independent investigation, and this is basically to determine relevant facts, which would include interviewing the child, the parents, teachers, and also to observe the child in the home, to advocate for the best interests of the child, which may include appropriate community services, to maintain confidentiality, except where sharing is permitted by law in order to promote cooperation, to monitor best interests throughout the proceedings, and also to present written reports that include conclusions and recommendations and the facts upon which they are based. And just a few program facts for you. We have a $24 million two-year budget. Right now, there are two-year budget. Right now, there are 649 guardians ad litem. 210 of these are employees, 449 are volunteers, and as I indicated previously, the volunteer programs are primarily Hennepin and Ramsey, and the First District also has some volunteers. We do have 100% coverage on our mandated cases. That compares to in 2001, prior to the state funding, there's only 55% coverage on the mandated cases. That has increased each year along with certain caseload increases. In 2009, over 15,000 children were served on over 12,000 cases. That compares to in 2003, a little under 7,000 cases where close to 11,000 children were served. And what the current structure is, the 10 guardian ad litem programs, one in each judicial district. And several challenges that are facing our board is, obviously, we do want to maintain 100% compliance with our mandates. We want to, as a new board, ensure that the mandated duties that the legislature put forth are carried out. We also want to study the delivery of the guardian ad litem services on a statewide basis and make recommendations to ensure that the mandated duties are carried out in the most effective and efficient manner. This would include things like sharing of resources across program lines, a better coordination, and also to design and implement administrative structure and policies and procedures.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions of the testifier on this issue? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Legro, could you provide at some point, not necessarily today, but some kind of trend line that with respect to your budget over the last 10 years and also the number of cases, so I have some idea of the direction it's going or has been going. Thank you.
Very good. Also, I just remind the committee, if any additional questions arise, feel free to see the chairman or the committee, your committee administrator, and we'll make any requests for additional information. Any questions further? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
All right, we've got one more overview of civil legal services. Gary Hurd. Let's try to conclude in 15 minutes. There are some meetings that have cropped up at 10 o'clock, and I'd like to see members can get to them.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go right ahead.
Chairman Smith, Leader Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today to discuss the role of civil legal services in helping to advance the state's constitutional obligation to provide access to justice. My name is Gary Hurd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. And joining me today to help address any questions you may have is Jerry Lane, Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. We are here today representing the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition and to provide an overview of the civil legal services component of the Supreme Court budget. Today I'm going to cover the following topics: the structure of delivering civil legal services in Minnesota, a description of the services we provide, a description of the impact of those services, and a description of the key challenges facing Minnesota's civil legal services system. Your committee packets include a handout of the PowerPoint presentation that summarizes the points I'll be making in my remarks. Civil legal services, along with the courts and public defenders, are an essential element of Minnesota's justice system and a core government service. Just as the public defenders protect access to justice for those with limited means facing criminal charges, legal aid extends similar access to justice for those who are dealing with civil matters but who cannot afford legal assistance on their own. As observed by Chief Justice Gilday, the justice system is an ecosystem in which all parts contribute to the vitality of the whole. The courts and other parts of the justice system work best for all Minnesotans when services such as those offered by legal aid and public defender services are there to assure that all have access. Minnesota's Legal Services Coalition is a statewide resource. It is comprised of 7 regional legal assistance programs which deliver services in every county in the state. In addition to these 7 regional legal services programs, Minnesota supports the delivery of civil legal services by an additional 24 community and special practice programs. State funds for the coalition programs and these community and special practice programs are administered through the Legal Services Advisory Committee, or LSAC. This is a committee appointed by the Supreme Court. Together, we share the mission of assuring access to open, affordable, and understandable services to all Minnesotans, regardless of income. The kinds of services that we provide include full representation in court and before administrative agencies, negotiation with adverse parties or government agencies, conciliation to help settle disputes without the need for a court or agency decision, providing advice and answering legal questions, and providing community education and preventive law services through presentations and printed materials. We focus on our services on cases that address the most critical needs of low-income Minnesotans. While the specific priorities are established by the boards of each of the programs, the critical needs that comprise the focus of our work include addressing housing issues, family problems, health care issues, income support, support for children, and personal safety. All of our services are subject to income and asset tests. These client eligibility guidelines are established through state and federal law. Minnesota's civil legal services programs provide assistance to Minnesota families by handling approximately 52,900 cases annually. Additionally, we reach nearly 70,000 Minnesotans with legal education and preventive law services. And we also provide about 650,000 units of service with hits to our websites. To give you some sense of who uses our services, 65% of those benefiting from our services are women and children. 30% are persons living with disabilities, physical or mental disabilities. And 13% of our clients are seniors, persons who are age 60 or over. Total funding for civil legal services in Minnesota is approximately $34 million a year. This includes a combination of private donations, federal funds, and state funds. I should note this combination of resources is augmented by an additional $15 million in donated legal services that are made available through the coordination and support of civil legal services pro bono programs. As I noted previously, LSAC, the Legal Services Advisory Committee, is responsible for allocating resources made available for civil legal services through the three-legged stool of state support. This includes annual funding from the State General Fund of approximately $11.8 million, funding from IOLTA, or the Interest on Lawyer Trust Account Program, of approximately $600,000, and funds from the attorney registration fees of approximately $1.8 million. Civil legal services is, in some respects, an efficiency program within the justice system. The legislature and the people of Minnesota expect the justice system to use their resources wisely. Civil legal services is an essential component to the efficient operation of the system. Civil legal services provides an essential screening function for the courts. We screen out approximately 3,000 cases per year by advising prospective litigants that they do not have a meritorious claim. In addition, civil legal services reduces the number of cases with unrepresented parties appearing in court, a valuable time saver in the courtroom. If civil legal services were not already part of the court's budget, you might very well be asking the courts to create a system to perform these functions in a quest for greater efficiency. One of the largest areas of demand for our services is in family law, and a major focus of our family law work is assisting victims of domestic violence. Civil legal services breaks the cycle of domestic violence for many families. It helps them restructure their lives, creates safety and stability for the children, and increases the chances of breaking the family cycle of poverty. Research has shown that the availability of civil legal services is one of only two statistically significant factors in reducing the local rates and resulting harm of domestic violence. Additionally, you should know that legal aid played an important role in helping to develop a tool that is now in expanded use in the courtrooms throughout the state to help judges assess lethality in domestic cases. This legislature passed a series of protections for homeowners facing foreclosure. Our work helped Tammy obtain the benefits of those protections and stopped an equity skimming company from unlawfully taking the home in which she and her children had lived for 15 years. The workout provided an affordable way for the family to keep their home. Civil Legal Services prevents homelessness for thousands of families each year by obtaining needed repairs, helping eligible families access public or subsidized housing, and by helping families respond to the mortgage foreclosure crisis. These services save approximately $4 million annually in tax-supported shelter costs and by preventing homelessness in over 2,650 cases. Studies show that Civil Legal Services help reduce local crime and school truancy by reducing the impact of homelessness, particularly for youth. Dolores is 74 years old and is wheelchair-bound. She relies on home health services to stay in the home she has lived in for 40 years. When the county unreasonably cut the number of hours of home health care to which she was entitled, she was faced with having to move to a nursing home. We appealed the county's decision and obtained a restoration of Dolores' home health services, preventing an unnecessary move to a more expensive and less comfortable nursing facility. Civil Legal Services helps people with disabilities, seniors, and families needing education and training to make the transition from welfare to work. Our services secure $5 million annually in new federal disability payments for Minnesotans that produce a cumulative economic impact of approximately $275 million over 10 years. As with all partners in Minnesota's justice system, Civil Legal Services providers are doing their best to assure the quality and value of our services while also responding to fiscal pressures. Faced with steep declines in various sources of funding since the 1980s, Civil Legal Service agencies in Minnesota started redesigning services to achieve efficiencies well before the state entered its current cycle of budget challenges. We have had to deal with inadequate funding for a very long time. Operating economically and efficiently is a way of doing business in legal aid. We are continually evaluating and improving our systems for delivering services. As observed by District Court Judge David Knudsen, this is an ongoing integrated part of how Civil Legal Services does its work. We have allocated resources to limit the focus of our work to crisis needs. We have integrated technology improvements to ease access to services and improve efficiency of internal systems. We have found ways to keep costs low by collaborating on training for our staff and other professionals who help us meet our clients' needs. And perhaps most importantly, we have benefited from the high quality, high value services provided by a motivated workforce and committed volunteers, a workforce that delivers results even though their salaries are the lowest in the justice system. In closing, I'd like to briefly identify some of the challenges we face in assuring access to justice for all Minnesotans through Civil Legal Services programs. One is a severe revenue crunch created by the loss of IOLTA revenue due to the recession and lowered interest rates. IOLTA revenue has declined 80% over the past 3 years, from $3.8 million annually to $600,000. The recession has also affected the number of people seeking services. The simple fact is that our services are counter-cyclical. The need for Civil Legal Services increases during times of economic downturns. The recession has produced a 40% increase in requests for services from legal aid agencies. Many of those new people coming through our doors seeking help to cope with the recession's impact are people who did not expect to ever need or even qualify for services from a legal aid agency. As with others in the justice system, the impact of recent budget cuts is affecting our capacity to deliver service. In 2009, Civil Legal Services programs provided extended representation, assistance with court or administrative proceedings to 9,939 Minnesotans. And that reflects a 9.8% reduction in extended representation cases and corresponds to the reduction in Civil Legal Services attorney positions due to general fund budget reductions from 2007 to 2009. Finally, we continue to cope with chronic challenges posed by having a pay scale for attorneys that is the lowest in the justice system, and the reality that our current funding, at best, meets 50% of the need of low-income Minnesotans. One of every two people who seek our services needs to be turned away due to lack of staff support to provide service. Lastly, I'd like to thank this committee and others in the legislature for the history of bipartisan support for civil legal services and the broader justice system. We'd also like to recognize the support of Chief Justice Lori Gilday. She's spoken to you about the importance of civil legal services. And we'd also like to recognize and thank our colleagues in the Chief Justice's Coalition to Preserve Minnesota's Justice System.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, we're going to have you back and discuss your budget request at a later time, but could you take like a half a minute, go back to page 16 or cell 16, and just tell us again what IOLTA stands for? And you're talking about an 80% reduction to a 7% of your pie. So how many dollars and cents is that? What is IOLTA, and why are you losing 80% of 7%, and how much is that?
Mr. Chairman, IOLTA is the Interest on Lawyers Trust Account program. When attorneys have either small amounts for clients or amounts that are going to be held for a short period of time on clients' behalf, those funds are deposited into a pooled account. The interest on those accounts, by statute, are paid to the court to distribute to civil legal services. Because of interest rate reductions and also the lower level of economic activity, the funds in those accounts are not earning the interest they used to. And so in this past or current biennium, which will end in June, there was $2.2 million approximately distributed statewide from the IOLTA program. For the biennium coming in July, the amount that will be available for those annual grants drops from $2.2 million to $500,000.
So that, doing the math in your head, how much is that?
$1.7 million reduction.
Any further questions, Representative Grunhagen?
I'll pass.
Anything else? Gentlemen, thank you for coming forward. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further business before the committee? If not, this committee, until next Tuesday, stands adjourned.